Oh, jeez.
Lufta.
Oh, my gosh.
You're listening to Aw Geez, a Fargo recap podcast from Minnesota Public Radio.
We're here to provide an authentic Minnesota perspective on a show that's named after a city in North Dakota.
Every week, we go over what happened and who is dead now. We ask experts to weigh in on the show and talk about the murders, the mob, the music, and more. I'm Tracy Mumford. I write about books for Minnesota Public Radio, and I watch a fair amount of TV.
I'm Jay Gabler. I write about music for The Current and Your Classical, and I'm an editor at a pop culture blog called The Tangential. This week, we talked to Ted Danson's real-life counterpart, Minnesota's own Rock County Sheriff Evan Verbrugge. He tells us about what Laverne is really like and his own encounter with some mysterious lights. But first, we need to talk about what happened last night.
Last night, we picked up exactly where we left off at the end of the last episode, in Peggy and Ed's house, with Lou leading Ed out the door for some questioning.
In cuffs. Ed is being aggressively taken into the station.
And Peggy's finally playing the role of caring wife and saying, "You can't take my Ed away. You know, he didn't do anything. It's unprovable." But they take him away anyway, and Ted Danson is left to wrangle Peggy at home, which is not a job I would want at this point.
Me and Ed, we're just bystanders. Not even. Disconnected. Him with the shop and me just trying to actualize fully, you know? Be the best me I can be, because these are modern times, you know? And a woman, well, she just doesn't have to be a wife and a mother no more. She can be, there's nothing she can't be.
You're a little touched, aren't you?
What?
It's not that there's anything wrong with that, don't get me wrong. It's just the time and place in which you're...
Well, you know, if you mean I got dreams, then yeah. And maybe I don't see it all like everybody else, but I got plans.
We actually get quite a bit of character development for Peggy as she talks with the situation about Hank, and he's trying to sort of talk her down and talk some sense into her, right?
I don't know. I think she's more unhinged than ever, but you are disagreeing with me.
No, I think she is just trying to play cool, right? Obviously, it's not a very cool situation, but she's trying to sort of play it off, say, oh, the whole incident at the butcher shop, it must have just been like a botched robbery. You know, I don't know what's going on, but she's still planning to go to her LifeSpring seminar.
But what she doesn't know is that Fargo is coming for them. So we go up back to the Gerhardt compound, and Bear and Dodd are having kind of a tense family moment there.
Precipitated by the fact that Bear gets his call from Charlie, who is surprisingly on his feet. I thought Charlie was in really bad shape after last episode, but as this episode opens, he just has a bandage on his head, but otherwise seems to be fine. Gets his one phone call, makes it to Bear, and Bear comes charging out of the Gerhardt home and tackles his brother, who he understands has set Bear's son Charlie on the hunt to kill Ed, or try to.
But Dodd is not having it. You know, he's saying, this is a direct attack on my power. And he pulls out his belt and he's going to whip Bear right there in front of everyone else.
With Dent standing by with a rifle to make sure that Bear doesn't go anywhere while he's being whooped.
And luckily, Floyd came out before any whooping started.
Not today. You'll kill us all. You split this family apart. Now tell me what happened.
I think it's a little too late for a family reunion, but maybe not. Maybe not.
Yeah, I don't think Bear and Dodd are going to be burying the hatchet anytime soon, except maybe in each other.
They do put their differences aside temporarily and head for Fargo. So now Floyd has dispatched them. Bear is heading there to get his son Charlie back, and Dodd is heading down to finish up this butcher business because Ed somehow is still not dead.
Floyd has to reiterate it. The butcher doesn't live.
Dodd's like, night.
He's already dead. Don't worry about it.
So little do they know that Simone is kind of eavesdropping on all of this business and gives Mike Milligan a quick call to let him know that all of the cavalry is headed down to Fargo. Bear, Dodd, Hansi, everybody. But that's not really going to play out how she thinks it will.
No, probably not. And meanwhile, Hank is still trying to reason with Peggy. We're back at Ed and Peggy's home. Everybody's on their way. And Hank is still trying to talk Peggy into telling the true story of what happened, because the cops still don't know exactly what happened, even though they have a pretty good idea that Rye was taken out with Peggy's car. They don't know who was driving or what the exact circumstances were, but Peggy is still refusing to say what happened.
Well, and the poor Blomquist they just can't get rid of this car. So they try and crash it and stage it as an accident. She tries to sell it to Sonny, and that ends up being the downfall, because now, as Ted Danson, Hank tells us, they're going to call in some techs and examine the car microscopically.
Because, you know, those people from up in the cities can examine things down to the atomic level.
They've got some
tech. He informs Peggy. Darn tootin'.
Well, and since she sold it to Sonny, Sonny's like, sure, search the car. So selling the car to Sonny turns out to have been a big misstep in this case. I couldn't help but think that Ted Danson's role on CSI was sort of informing this part of Hank. All of a sudden, he's pulling out all this science knowledge. I was impressed.
It is sort of a parody of that. I hadn't picked up on that. Fargo arrives, and Ted Danson goes out on the porch to have a talk with Dodd while Peggy is instructed to hide in the house.
Which, if you remember what their house looks like, there are a lot of places to hide in all of those crazy magazines that she's piled up.
Crazy like a fox. Peggy Blomquist.
Maybe. But things between Dodd and Ted Danson don't go amicably, I would say. And Hansi Dent takes Hank down with a rifle butt to the head.
Hank is down unconscious. Dodd and the crew come in to search the house. And they find Peggy, but not before she finds them.
She gets Dodd's cattle prod. Which, if you watch carefully, you can see he kind of sets it down on the shelf when he's working his way through the hoarding piles of magazines that Peggy has. And she manages to pick it up. And as I was declaring last night, Dodd gets the prod.
He gets the prod so hard.
She zaps him so hard, he sizzles twice.
She prods him into outright unconsciousness, just mercilessly prods him. And before that even happens, Peggy has already taken out Dodd's accomplices somehow with a kitchen sink. It's a little unclear whether the sink just falls on the guy's head or whether Peggy somehow dislodges it. But
I don't know. Peggy's got a lot of rage. And then Dodd accidentally shoots one of his own henchmen conveniently for Peggy, which makes me think, like, how many henchmen does Dodd accidentally go through a week? I don't know.
Yeah, we'll get back to the absurdity of Dodd later on in our discussion, but he had a rough week.
Ed, also having kind of a rough week, is in the interrogation room at the sheriff's station, and Lou's trying to explain to him, you know, I gave you your chance, and you didn't take my help, and look where we're at now.
And it's like, yeah, I'm going to want a lawyer.
You hear that, Sonny? There is a crisis at the highest level, so who do they call? The best lawyer in town.
Aren't you the only lawyer in town, Carl?
Yes, but that's because I scared away all my great Caesar's ghost.
It turns out there's only one lawyer in Luverne, the finest lawyer in Luverne by default, and that is Carl Weathers, a delightfully inebriated Nick Offerman who is throwing back some beers at the VFW right at the moment they need him.
Despite the fact that Carl's a little unsteady on his feet and is going to need a designated driver, Sonny, who we later learn just goes ahead and brings a roadie with him in the car anyway. So Carl accepts the assignment and heads to the police station to represent Ed.
So Carl shows up at the police station and he is just spewing like Shakespearean monologues about freedom and rights. And he calls Lou a tool of the state. I mean, he's firing on all cylinders. Nick Offerman is just chewing the scene up. He's clearly relishing every moment of this.
Rights that were squeezed from British oppression like water from a stone. That all men are created equal, free from the jackboot tyranny and gulag magic tricks of nameless, faceless committees.
Hey, hope they didn't wake you.
Out of my way, tool of the state, for I am come to comfort and counsel my client, even as you seek to prison him.
Whatever you gotta do, you got 30 minutes.
But all of this spit and fire doesn't really seem to help Ed out very much. I was confused when he was trying to explain his plan to Ed about, like, shake your head with the letter G if you're not. We'll assume it's a yes. I mean, I don't. Maybe if he'd had a few beers less, I could have understood that bit.
Yeah, it's left unclear how effectual Carl would be as a lawyer if he were sober. But actually, he has his moment later on. But we'll get to that. First, we need to explain that the station is, in fact, laid siege to by the other half of the Fargo contingent.
So Bear and his henchmen have arrived, and they are not going to leave without both Charlie and Ed. Lou goes out there. He tries to reason with him. That doesn't work. He retreats back into the station. Carl pulls a little bench in front of the door. Like, that's going to stop all of the guns that they have outside, and they need to make a plan.
Carl pours himself a cup of coffee. He's going to sober up for this. And so, yeah, so Lou's plan is that Carl is going to go out as the now newly appointed lawyer of not just Ed, but also Charlie, and try to talk with the family to buy the cops some time. They've called in support, but the support is not going to make it there for another half hour bare minimum. So meanwhile, Lou is trying to slip out the back of the police station with Ed in tow. Lou thinks Ed is still under arrest. Ed doesn't think so, but more on that later.
Whether or not anyone had any faith in him, Carl Weathers comes to the rescue. He manages to convince Bear that busting Charlie out of jail will make Charlie a fugitive for life. And if they just leave him in jail, he's only 17, he's a minor, he'll be able to have a clean record, he'll be able to live a normal life, which we all know is what Bear wants for his son.
The maximum is 10 years. He's out in 5 for good behavior. Done. But this, you take him out of here now, and he's running the rest of his life. A wanted fugitive, shoot on sight. But there's a way out. Leave now. Take your men, and none of this falls on the kid. This is the deal I made. He stays clean. But you gotta go. Now.
It's really impressive how this scene sort of moves from farce to tragedy. You know, it sort of starts out as this comical scene with this inebriated Carl Weathers trying to pull himself together and make up some BS. But by the end of it, it's almost poignant, as Carl is pointing out the boy is only 17. It's clear that Carl is terrified. Nice acting job by Nick Offerman, with tears brimming in his eyes as he tries to coolly pull out a smoke. And we obviously see that Bear is affected as well. And in the end, it's successful. Fargo gets back in their cars and drives off as Lou and Ed run through the woods, pursued, unbeknownst to them, by Dent.
But Bear is going to have a little surprise when he gets home, because at the Gerhardt compound, just as Floyd and Simone are having this heart-to-heart about how there are no women's roles and men's roles, a bunch of men show up with guns. It's Milligan, it's the remaining kitchen brother, and some unnamed Kansas City people we haven't seen before, and they are firing on the house.
So we see sort of another one of the equivalent of a Gerhardt red shirt go down, and we see Floyd and Simone dive to the floor. We don't know what's going to happen to Otto, but Kansas City is just peppering the Gerhardt compound with bullets at this point.
Right, because last time we saw Otto, he was sitting in the kitchen and Floyd was feeding him, and he can't duck. So based on what we saw in the scenes for next time as well, I don't think Otto's chances of survival are high.
Maybe it'll turn into like a Bill Murray from Steve Zissou moment, where he just stands up and grabs a gun and unexpectedly becomes a hero.
We'll have to wait and see. You know who's not being a hero is Ed, who cannot follow basic directions. So it turns out Hank is fine. He just has this nasty head wound. He's driving his cruiser very slowly down the back roads, I think, because he's slightly impaired. He's seeing double. And he meets up with Ed and Lou coming out of the woods. And the minute that he gets there, Ed just bolts for it. And they just kind of watch him run down the road like, how, really? Like, you want us to chase you again? We're trying to save you. What are you doing?
So they get in the car and drive off. And the episode ends as Dent paces slowly and malevolently down the road after Ed.
To a sweet cover of Man of Constant Sorrow by Blitzentrapper, another great Coen Brothers song cover.
Let's talk about the aliens, or the lack thereof.
We had a completely alien-free episode, unless you saw something and you should tell us on Twitter, but we watched it twice, and there was not even a strange light to be found in the sky.
Are the aliens silently gathering their forces to make a greater impression in the next episode, or are we just done with aliens now?
I don't think we're done.
Probably not.
You're never done with aliens.
And what we are certainly not done with is existentialism. So the title of this episode is Rhinoceros, which is the name of a key play in the Theater of the Absurd. It's a play about a guy who is sort of the one remaining quasi-sane character while everybody around him fights and turns into rhinoceroses. And what does the world even mean?
So we were talking about this last night. Like, is Lou the sane one and everyone around him is going crazy, is turning into rhinoceri?
We also get a recital of the poem The Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll, which is recited by Mike Milligan as he saddles up.
"'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wave. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the moon wraiths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son. The jaws that bite, the claws that catch."
Why the Jabberwock? I'm sure a lot of viewers were left wondering why this particular poem. When you think about it, it's a very absurd poem. It's a lot of nonsense words, but it sounds kind of cool and threatening. And that could be, you could think about Dodd that way, right? That he seems really threatening, and he seems kind of scary, but ultimately, he's just an absurd character who falls apart and doesn't really have any spine behind his threats.
Oh, I know why he's quoting the Jabberwocky. Because, so we have in that moment, Milligan and Simone are talking about taking out Dodd. Simone is telling Milligan what she wants Milligan to tell her dad before he kills her. So she's plotting the death of her father. And what she wants him to tell him is, "Kiss my grits," which is a line out of a 70s and early 80s sitcom, Alice. Alice in Wonderland, that kicks off the Jabberwocky.
All right. That's why
Milligan starts quoting Lewis Carroll.
I hadn't picked that up, but that's a good connection. We also get another take on existentialism from Ed. Once again, we come back to Noreen and her reading of Camus. In the last episode, we learned what Noreen's take on the book was, which is that she thinks life is meaningless and we're all going to die, so what's even the point? But this time around, while Ed is talking with Lou in the station, he explains this whole legend of Sisyphus, this guy who just kept pushing a rock up a hill. So the conventional interpretation of that, or Camus' interpretation, is that it illustrates the futility of life. But it turns out that Ed sort of sees Sisyphus as like a working man's hero.
"It's about this guy who every day he pushes this rock up this hill like a boulder. And then every night it just rolls back down. But he doesn't stop. You know, he keeps going. And he wakes up every day and he starts pushing. By which I guess I'm saying, it doesn't matter what they throw at me. I'm going to take care of what's mine."
Speaking of Ed, how does he keep escaping? Like, he's like the roadrunner. How does he keep escaping death?
I was thinking, we've sort of been talking about maybe the closest equivalent to Malvo being maybe someone like Hansi Dent in this season. But really, maybe the closest equivalent to Malvo in this season are Ed and Peggy, who are just as unstoppable as Malvo seemed to be in season number one. Every situation they get into, they somehow get out of largely unscathed.
And so we should also talk about Peggy. The big question for me this episode is, crazy or crazy like a fox? I'm kind of on the crazy side. Like, when she's rambling to Ted Danson, to Hank, all about how she wants to go to California, she feels like she lives in this museum of the past. I mean, I feel for her, but she's definitely unsettled. She is not showing the proper amount of, like, terror that she should be in this situation.
And I understand that, you know, we know that Kirsten Dunst sees the character as crazy. She's talked about that. So I'm ready for more revelations as the season goes on. But if I was just sort of watching this season with no other information about what's going on in Peggy's head, I don't know that I would be thinking she's crazy, you know? I think she's kept a cool head about things.
When she tells Ted Danson that she's still looking forward to going to the LifeSpring seminar the next day, I was like, she's totally lost it.
We learn more about how Peggy feels trapped in this situation. She explains to Hank that this is Ed's house. This is his family's house. It's where he grew up. It's where he ran around. How does she put it? Ran around in his little tidy whities or whatever.
Which he did as an adult, too. We saw that.
That's true. We've seen more than we really needed to of Ed and his tidy whities, so we can all too well imagine. But anyway, so Peggy really explains how she feels like this is just not her life. We've had intimations of this before, but she's really started giving us more detail about how she feels like she needs a change. She needs to get out of here. And she's almost looking forward to escaping to California.
But that's just not reasonable. Like, her husband's just been arrested, and she has the Rock County Sheriff in her kitchen. I don't know. Whatever. We'll see. We'll see what happens with Peggy. One thing to talk about for sure is the gender roles and the little bits of feminism that were peppered throughout this episode. Mike Milligan, definitely surprise feminist of the episode. When Simone's on the phone with him and she's talking about how Dodd has called her a whore, that was a touching family moment.
I got every right.
Of course you do. We're in full agreement, you and me. A beautiful body, and you can do what you want with it.
Yeah, it's interesting how we get both the Gerhardt side and then on Ed and Peggy's side, these discussions of sort of freedom and liberation. And clearly on both sides, the women are seeing this as an opportunity to change their roles in life. They felt somewhat trapped or caged in by the status quo on the Gerhardt side. Clearly, Floyd was not taken seriously as a person of influence, nor was Simone. And now they're both having their opportunity. Floyd says as much. And then on Peggy's side, she's also seeing this as a chance to change her life and get away to California, possibly to a better life than she would have had if there had never been any murder or mayhem in Laverne.
Here's the catch, though, is Floyd and Simone think that they have a shot of changing their lot in life. They think they have a shot of getting in control, but it keeps getting taken away from them. Like, Simone thinks that she's scheming and she's playing it, but she thinks Mike Milligan's going to go to Laverne and kill her dad, and instead he shows up at the Gerhardt compound and annihilates their house, basically could have shot up Simone and wouldn't have cared. So it's clearly not working out for Simone and for Floyd either. I mean, she was played by Dodd in the last episode. Her sons clearly aren't listening to her. So when Floyd's telling Simone, you know, there's no such thing as women's work and men's work anymore, we can do whatever we want, I don't think it's a coincidence that right at that moment, men shoot up the house and destroy that moment of equality that we're having.
This is our time. No such thing as men's work, women's work anymore. We get just as much right to...
So, as we pointed out earlier, there's a lot of Western activity going on. I mean, I think anytime you have a sheriff in a show, you automatically think of Westerns. We've got all this Western imagery. We've got the prairies, and we've got Lou as the shining star of morality in a corrupt village or corrupt town. And in this episode with the siege, Lou even calls out how much of a Western it is. He tells Bear, like, this never works in Westerns. And it doesn't work in this episode either. But
when you noticed all the Western artifacts that are on display in Ed and Peggy's house.
I hadn't realized how much of a Western decoration theme they had outside. They had that big cow skull and that cowboy boot made out of wire on the front porch.
And we talked in the last episode about how sort of Ed's theme song is this Burl Ives cowboy song that might reflect how in Ed's mind he's still back in this 1950s world where there's good and there's evil and you do what you have to do for the right people, but you know, obviously the rest of the characters are not so sure whether moral certainties make any sense in the real world.
Which is interesting when you think about his interaction with Carl, because as confusing as Carl's directions were about telling him whether he was guilty or not guilty, Ed didn't count himself as either. He didn't count himself as guilty or not guilty.
I took that to be less Ed's moral uncertainty and more Carl's confused instructions.
I don't know.
But so thinking about how Ed was influenced by growing up in the 50s and watching cowboy shows on TV, let's talk about TV and all the references to TV in this episode.
We've seen TVs in earlier episodes. We saw one TV maybe playing like a World War II film. But in this, I mean, Simone drops a bunch of TV references when she's talking about how awful a father Dodd has been. You know, she's saying basically like Ozzy from Ozzy and Harriet, that's a dad. My dad isn't a dad. And we get this point where people are starting to compare their lives to the perfect pop culture they're seeing on the TV, and it doesn't measure up.
You've got all these characters in this show who think they're experts on the situation because they've seen TV. They think they know how it's supposed to work. The irony being, they're in a TV show, and it's not working that way.
Exactly, because Ed says, you know, he's been watching all these police shows on TV. He knows his rights. He knows how this investigation should go on. He wants a lawyer. But I'm thinking about how different Fargo, the TV show, is from all these simplistic TV shows that they're referencing, and if that's kind of a sly nod to how TV has changed.
Yeah, and yet, you know, it is certainly more complex and more ambiguous. There were not a lot of explicit references to existentialism in cops and robbers shows in the 1950s, for sure. And yet those tropes still work, right? One of the reasons we're so engaged in this episode, a lot of people on Twitter were saying, you know, how heart-stopping it was. They're on the edge of their seats. They're in great suspense to see what happens next. It's because we do feel like we know good guys and bad guys. You are sort of rooting for Ed and Peggy, and you're hoping that Kansas City doesn't prevail, and you're hoping that Simone finds her heart of gold. And so those tropes are still with us, and they're still working in the context of this episode, even as they're playing with them.
Fargo, especially last night, makes life in Minnesota law enforcement look like a total Western shootout. So we called up the real Rock County Sheriff, the role played by Ted Danson on the show, and that's Sheriff Evan Verbrugge. We wanted to see what it was actually like out there. He's lived in Luverne for 25 years, and he had a few things to point out about what's fact and what's fiction.
All right, Sheriff, let's just jump right into this. Is there a Waffle Hut in Luverne, Minnesota?
There is not a Waffle Hut here.
So that is pure fiction.
That is pure fiction. We've got a little mom-and-pop restaurant called Papa's Place. But as far as a Waffle Hut or a 24-hour Waffle Hut, I've been in Luverne for, 25 years. And then my mother grew up in the county here, too. And I remember coming here as a kid and never seen a 24-hour restaurant at all.
Have you had people coming through town because of the show looking for the Waffle Hut or any other landmarks they've seen in the show?
Yeah, actually we did. A couple weeks ago, I was going through the courthouse and I had a couple from Illinois that actually stopped me and asked me about the particulars of the case. And I advised them that is purely just fiction. It just happens to be a town that was used. So
what kinds of crimes do you actually deal with in Rock County?
You know, most of ours are verbal disagreements between two parties, of minor vandalisms, some traffic, but overall, and maybe some identity theft, but we don't really have violent crime here. We are a bedroom community for Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which is about 30 miles away here. So most of our individuals that live here are about 45 or older. We're really pretty quiet. Everybody knows everybody, like all these small towns, and we really don't deal a lot with really crime.
As far as you know, has there ever been any organized crime, any mob-related incidents in the era, even going back to the 70s?
I guess I'm not aware of any. We've had an occasional, in the early 90s, individuals that wanted to be gang members. That was kind of big in this area, Sioux Falls, Worthington, Sioux City. And so those individuals would stay in Luverne, and then they think that they were kind of big individuals because they were a gang member. But other than that, that was very far and few between. So we really haven't had any organized crime at all.
Have you been watching the show?
I have.
So aside from the nature of the specific crime that's happening on screen, do you feel like the show is sort of capturing what it's like to be a law enforcement professional in the Luverne area? Do the characters seem generally true to life?
This was based in 1979, so things were a little bit different. And the stories that I've heard from individuals from former sheriffs at that time, you know, that was probably depicted fairly well.
So on the show, the Rock County Sheriff is played by Ted Danson.
Yeah.
How does that feel to be inhabiting the same role as Ted Danson?
Well, you know, I kind of look at it as, since it was based in 1979, I was only eight, so I don't know if I I can be depicted as a sheriff, but as the current sheriff, I guess it's kind of cool. He's got a little bit more hair than I do, so. but other than that, it is kind of cool to be recognized as far as being Laverne and people coming to Laverne and Rock County and being part of that. Said I don't have nothing to do with it, but it is kind of cool when people are talking. It's fun to talk with other friends about it.
So you grew up in Laverne? You're from the area?
I grew up in Worthington, which is 30 miles east of here. My wife is from Laverne, and one thing on the show, the state trooper, he's married to the sheriff's daughter. I am the sheriff, and my wife is a stepdaughter of a state trooper. So it was kind of cool to see some of that similarities there. It's different, but similar.
I got to ask, you've seen the first couple episodes, and there are some strange lights in the sky.
Yeah.
And people talk about that area of Minnesota having seen a lot of UFOs in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
Well, I will honestly say that it had to be, I suppose, 20 years ago, I suppose. A partner and I were both working on the southwest corner of the county, and there was some lights off there. Now, it's not UFO, I don't believe, but I remember listening to the radio stations and all that, and we were kind of seeing some lights. So whether it's true or not, it's all conversation piece, but I do remember one night working and seeing something.
That's crazy. And did you and your partner ever look into it?
Well, we both talked about it over the radio, saying, hey, do you see that light? And yep, I'm in Beaver Creek, he's in Hills, and it was kind of strange, but other than that, we didn't really investigate any further.
So if fans of the show were going to make a trip to Laverne, obviously modern Laverne,
mm-hmm.
What should they see? What will they find?
We are a prairie playground, it's called. Pretty flat. Laverne is a small community of 4,600 people. We've got the depiction of the show is fairly clear and similar. We do have a palace theater, it's called, which is over 100-some years old. We do have a meat market. We got some other little stores, things like that. We're so close to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, so a lot of people go there for their shopping and things. But if you just want to come and relax, Laverne is a nice, quiet community.
How close are you to Fargo?
To Fargo, we are 4-plus hours away.
So the scene early in the season when the judge drives from Fargo to Laverne, that would be quite a trek.
That is, yep. In the wintertime and everything, it's quite a trek, no doubt about it.
So must have been some good waffles to make it worth the drive.
Absolutely, yep.
How do you feel about the accents on the show?
Well, they're a little far-fetched, than what normally, but I think there's a lot of people around here that do say the you betcha and that type of conversation there, but I know I get it myself every once in a while, but we don't have that strong accent like the Canadian accent it is done.
Well, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Not a problem. Have a good day.
You too. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Let's check in on the body count. We got a quick refresher at the top of the episode from Hank, who said there's 5 dead in Laverne, 15 dead up in Fargo. I don't know if they're counting Skip Spring, if they found that little nubbin of his tie.
I'm thinking they're not counting Skip Spring. I think Skip Spring's demise is still unknown.
A mystery. And by the end of this episode, I think we added 3 bodies because we had the Gerhardt henchman up at the compound.
Yeah, he's definitely dead.
He definitely got mowed down. We have the henchman that Dodge shoots in Peggy and Ed's basement.
And we're pretty sure he's dead?
He fell and he didn't move.
I mean, Charlie got shot and went down, and Charlie is just right as rain these days.
But that character had a name. If you don't have a name and your character gets shot, I don't think you're getting back up.
Okay, so we got 1 down, maybe 2, and then what about the sink guy?
I don't know if sink guy's down for the count or not.
We probably won't be seeing any more of him.
Probably not.
I feel like you have a sink dropped on your head. It's you're at least out for the season.
So potentially 3 more in this episode. And potentially Otto, but we won't confirm that until next time.
And we were talking a little bit last night about how we haven't seen a lot of named characters go down so far in this season that we keep thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be it. This is when, you know, this person's going to get it. This person, when that person's going to get it, we were really afraid for Hank's life tonight. And yet all the characters who we know well seem to be making it through for the most part, at least in the last couple of episodes.
I have big questions about where Peggy is now. So Ted Danson wakes up from his head wound
right on
the porch of the Blomquist house. The last thing we saw, Peggy was in the basement zapping Dodd, and two henchmen were down, maybe dead. And Ted Danson just gets in his car and starts driving. So to me, that says, as you pointed out, either his head wound was worse than we thought and he's totally out of it, or Peggy is not at the house anymore.
So my take is that you're Ted Danson. You wake up, you assume that Peggy is gone. You see the Gerhardts are gone. You assume that they have either killed or taken Peggy. You certainly don't see her. And your first priority is to do what Hank does, which is to radio into the station. The station says, oh, hi, we're under siege. And so Hank is like, all right, I'm on my way.
But the station tells him not to come. I don't know. I just think that was a big question left hanging about, like, what is happening in that basement? Does Peggy escape on her own? Does she tie up Dodd? I mean, where's Peggy and where's Dodd?
That's true. We're left to assume that they're both alive. Dodd's incapacitated. What's Peggy going to do with Dodd? Now is the question.
Give him a haircut. Ah, Geez is produced by Tracy Mumford, Jay Gabler, and Molly Bloom. Many thanks to John Gordon and Steve Nelson.
We're live tweeting the episodes on Twitter at AwGeez Podcast. That's AwJeez Podcast.
Our theme music is by the Valdons, courtesy of Secret Stash Records. Okay, then.
Bye now.
Bye now.